So if somebody asked you who the founders and pillars of your community were, could you give a list in a short amount of time? Arcadia Publishing may make it easy for you. This is the same company that publishes books on towns and cities all over the country with historical facts and events and lots of pictures. The same company also publishes a Legendary Locals series profiling some of the people, past and present, who make a town what it is. Legendary Locals of Ashland recently landed in our office, followed today by its author, Sam Wheeler. His name probably rings a bell for Rogue Valley readers. He's worked as a staffer for both the Ashland Daily Tidings and its sister paper, the Medford Mail Tribune. He's now working as a freelancer. Sam is a graduate of Southern Oregon University in this decade. Welcome, Sam Wheeler.
Oh, thank you very much, Jeffrey.
Glad to have you here. So this is not just an Ashland project, as we pointed out. Could you tell us a little bit about the Legendary Local series and the general template for it?
Yeah, Arcadia Publishing, they've applied the Legendary Local series to towns all across the United States. So this is the Ashland version. These are the locals of Ashland who I guess one may call legendary.
Indeed. There are people past and present who have made a difference in town. How did you get involved with this project?
Arcadia actually contacted me. I'm not sure why they contacted me or if somebody told them to contact me, but they sent me an email, asked me if this was something I might be interested in doing, and I said absolutely.
Had you done anything long form before quite like this?
No, absolutely not. It was I was very naive going into it, looking back.
Naive in what way?
In the amount of work that it was going to take, and really in the response I was going to get from people. I got a really positive response from people, and everybody that I approached about being in the book was very excited and willing to work with me. But, of course, very interested in what was going to be said about them, you know, rightly so. So, you know, it's a bit of a time-consuming process to write something, have somebody check it and send it back and, you know, finalize a photo for 100 or so different people.
And how many times did that process go back and forth with some of the living people with, did I get this right?
Yeah, that's, the living people were, they had a little bit more to say than those who have passed, for sure.
But, I mean, how many times did you go back and forth with some of them?
Maybe a half dozen, mm-hmm. 10 times at most. Mm-hmm. Best case scenario, I write some, you know, I contact them, send them what I wrote. They say it looks great, send it back, you know, a couple times. So mm-hmm. at least three times probably.
So how much time did you have to spend with any of the living folks in here?
Well, a few of them I had known prior to taking on the project, so I'd spent a little bit more time with a few of them. Others I just made a point to, you know, sit down and have coffee with, or those that weren't around or able to meet, at least, you know, have a good phone conversation with, or, you know, just have a good conversation about, you know, some of the things they've done, what I was planning on writing about.
Which, again, is easy to do with the people who are living, but, yeah. I mean, how different a project to write about people who are not nearby? You can't pick up a phone and ask a bunch of questions.
Yeah, that's... I enjoyed very much doing the research, and that's where most of it, you know, was, in the people that can't speak for themselves and don't have people around to speak for them any longer. Just digging into some of the past records, just little snippets of what they said, or finding that one photograph, the only one that I could find of, you know, a particular individual, and putting it in the book. It was quite a bit more challenging to, you know, fill the space for those people, but it was probably one of the more enjoyable aspects of it.
Has Arcadia Publishing already done a book just about Ashland?
They have.
Yeah.
It's, you know, they've done a book about the Shakespeare Festival itself, and they've also done one about Ashland, and it is, it's just a general book covering mostly particular events throughout the town's history and buildings, as opposed to the people.
Did you get the benefits of the research out of those projects, though?
I mean, absolutely. Yeah. If it had not been for those two books and really just a handful of others that have been written by a couple local historians, I would have had nothing to go on.
I noticed that you gave some credit to Marjorie O'Hara in your acknowledgments.
Absolutely.
Her book about Southern Oregon was one of the first I read upon moving here 30 years ago. And that probably was a big boost to you.
Absolutely. And Marjorie is one of the people that I spent more time with than some of the others. She's an wonderful woman. I hope I made it clear enough in the book that, you know, I'm so grateful for the amount of work she's done to contribute to, you know, the history.
Preserving it for people to come along and pick it up like you.
Exactly.
So who makes the decision, Sam Wheeler, about who gets into the book and who does not get into the book? I mean, who ends up on the cutting room floor, so to speak?
Well, people ended up on the cutting room floor than made it into the book.
Really?
I mean, I sent a list initially to the publisher. There must have been nearly 300 people on it, you know. And then they had sent me a list almost simultaneously with 100 people on it. And I thought, well, there's 100 people you want in the book, and here's 300 people I think that would be good. And, you know, it was a painful process. And probably the most unenjoyable part of the entire project was crossing somebody's name off that I knew deserved just as much as the next person to be in the book. Narrowing it down, I tried to select people that would represent all of the different aspects of the community, or as many of the different aspects of the community as I, you know, could.
I can imagine that would be a painful process. And I mean, what, you know, given a choice of like, well, there's this person and there's this person, they did similar things. I mean, what kinds of factors went into making that decision?
Well, sometimes if we're talking about a historical figure, the amount of information that was available for me to write about. Other times it was, well, this person never got back to me after a month or 2 months of trying to get in touch with them, so I'm going to go with the other person.
Oh, so they make it easy.
As simple as that sometimes.
Right, who was available. All right, Sam Wheeler's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of Legendary Locals of Ashland, a book that looks at some of the movers and shakers in Ashland, past and present. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return from this break. Back with Sam Wheeler and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today with Sam Wheeler, a Rogue Valley journalist and graduate of Southern Oregon University. He was handed the somewhat daunting task of putting together a book about the legendary locals of Ashland. The Legendary Locals series is from Arcadia Publishing, which also publishes books on towns big and small across America. This is another chance to look at the towns, this time through the people who make those towns what they were and what they are, past and present. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Sam and maybe even mention some legendary locals that come to mind for you as we talk about the ones that he included. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Or by email, jx@jeffnet.org, or check out our Facebook page, and you can see the studio picture we snapped of Sam just a few moments ago. So we talked about the process of winnowing down. You had a list of 300 people, and Arcadia came back with a list of 100. So obviously 200 or so people ended up getting left out of the book. Some didn't contact you, and so it was easy to make the decision there. Ultimately, was it like right up to deadline with people getting back to you and stuff and making decisions on who stays and who goes?
Yeah, it was, actually. It was right up until the week that I submitted everything to them. And everything, by everything, I mean the photographs and the final text. I had, you know, probably a half dozen or less, maybe three people that I really wanted to include in the book that just were not getting back to me. And I think one of them didn't ever end up getting back to me, and the other two I think I got on the final day. I ended up getting their photos and just the okay from them.
All right, you put a disclaimer, it looks like, right up in front of the book about this is not necessarily a representative sample or something along those lines.
Yeah, it was something along those lines, just that I just wanted to make sure people knew that this isn't a definitive list. I probably left people out. I probably forgot people completely. That's all. It's just that there are more people that deserve to be in this book that I could fit in it.
And some, of course, you probably would have included if you had more information. But, for example, in writing about the native village that preceded Ashland, It seems like precious little is available to give you any sort of character studies of those of the data figures.
Yeah, as far as character studies go, it's very, very limited. You may find a few names that pop up a couple different times, but for the most part, it's very general. You know, these people lived here, and this is how long they lived here. But that's the part that I enjoyed most researching, actually. And I wish I would have been able to cover that quite a bit more. In fact, when I turned in the original text, I think I had the first chapter, which is primarily about the Native Americans who lived in the area prior to settlement. It was like thousands of words too long, they told me. Oh, you have to cut it. So I ended up cutting quite a big portion of the text about them. But it's a part of Southern Oregon's history that hasn't been written about enough and needs to be explored, you know, much more.
For that matter, were there not any images available? I mean, you write about Tipsu Tyee and some of the other people involved in the natives who lived in the Rogue Valley before the white people came and called it the Rogue Valley. No images abound?
No, there are a few images of Takelma Native Americans, and I think there are even some images, or an image, I should say, of a woman who lived, or who was in the band that lived in the southern portion of the Bear Creek Valley. And it's actually Shasta Native Americans, not Takelma, excuse me. But her name isn't included in it. Nobody, it's just very limited image-wise, especially, you know. What I was initially hoping to do was to include maybe some photos of artifacts. Jeff Leland, a couple other archaeologists, have done some work down on the plaza recently.
I was thinking that was going on while you were writing.
Yeah, throughout the past couple decades even have done a few digs down there and found some really nice artifacts. So I was thinking maybe I'll include just some photos of those, but I ended up not doing that.
How quickly did the white settlers move the Native Americans out? I mean, it seems like the span of years from...
We're talking less than 10 years.
Okay.
I think, what was Ashland, 1982? Was it settled?
1852.
It was before 1860 that there were milled lumber homes around the plaza. Where less than 10 years later, I mean, that was the village of the Shasta band that lived here.
Wow. So that quick a removal.
Very much.
Native Americans out and white people in. I understand the name that the white people gave to the town, Ashland itself, has a little bit of mystery to it.
The name that the white people gave to Ashland itself, yes, it was originally called Ashland Mills because there was a lumber mill built here that provided the miners around Jacksonville with lumber. But some people think it may have been named after Ashland, Ohio, because a number of settlers, including the Hellmans, came here from that area, so they thought, well, they named it after their hometown in Ohio. Others thought that it was named after, what was the Whig Party leader's name that I mentioned?
Henry Clay.
Henry Clay is from Ashland, Kentucky, and there are a number of locals here that identified with him politically. And so they thought that, oh, well, they named it in honor of him, I guess. Huh. So it's whatever side you want to choose, nobody really knows for sure.
Named after Ashland somewhere is all
yeah,
I know.
Yeah, precisely.
It's fun reading the names of the early white settlers and pillars of the community. For one thing, you figure out who some of the streets are named after. You just mentioned Abel Hellman.
Abel Hellman is one that stands out, you know, above anybody. Really, there's Professor Goetz, which I don't think a lot of people a lot of people don't know of him, but he actually was a superintendent of the public school district. And really helped just push public education in Ashland and helped the university a lot as well, just get off the ground because it struggled immensely during its first couple decades, several decades, I'll even say.
Well, I noticed about a year or two ago, the university was hanging banners that celebrated 140 years, but none of them pointed out it was not continuous.
No, it definitely
There were gaps of decades when there was no university, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely, there was no university at all. And there are, I mean, how many times has it been renamed as well? But yeah, there are a number of individuals in the book that, you know, they are those people that picked it back up after a decade lapse. You know, they got the university rolling again. And I think the community is definitely owes a lot to them, because SOU is definitely a very strong aspect of the community.
I want to come back to SOU just a little later on, but from the early settlement group, Abel Hellman, we talked about the street and the school are named for him. What was his story?
Abel Hellman came here from Ohio. He came here with Eber Emery is the man's name. And initially they moved west to be gold miners. They were crummy gold miners, it turned out. They were in Siskiyou County. And so Hellman gave up first and moved to the Wairika area, where he started running coaches over the Siskiyous. Between Wairika area and Willamette, in the Willamette Valley, they'd bring supplies to the miners from the Willamette. And he thought, well, this turns out to be far more lucrative than mining ever has been for me. So I think I'm going to get in the business of supplying the miners. So him and Emery moved over the Siskiyous and to the Southern Bear Creek Valley to Ashland, where they opened the lumber mill.
Just a place to be able to make some money.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the creation of Ashland. Abel Hellman we're talking about there. Sam Wheeler's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're just getting into some of the names in the book, Legendary Locals of Ashland, which Sam had a chance to put together for Arcadia Publishing. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Talk about legendary locals in your town, or if you recognize some of the names of the Ashlanders we're talking about along the way, jump in there too. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Was the process of research and discovery a real eye-opener, getting to know the town better and knowing things about it you might not have known?
Absolutely. It definitely humbled me a little bit, because I had been a staff writer for the Tidings for a couple of years, and I had worked for the Tribune and worked as a freelancer, so I thought, oh, I covered so much of Ashland, what's going to surprise me?
What else could I know, right?
Yeah, reading about Jesse Winburn, and he's a very odd character, and just some of the different initiatives that have come up in the community through the years. A lot of them will bring a chuckle, other ones will kind of raise an eyebrow or two. It allowed me to really get to know the community, and just, on more than a present basis,
Well, we were talking about the fact that you get to know at least where some of the street names came from as you read the names in the first chapter of the book, which is about the days of yeah. early white settlement.
Mm-hmm.
For example, not knowing who the Coolidge was, for whom Coolidge Street was named. Not Calvin, it turns out, but an early settler of Ashland.
Orlando Coolidge, yeah.
And you mentioned Jesse Winburn. What about Jesse Winburn stood out to you?
Oh, well, Winburn was a guy. He got rich off of subway advertising. He was the person who really sort of pitched the idea, mm-hmm. and he lived in New York. So he became extremely wealthy after that and decided he was going to move to Ashland, because when he visited here, it reminded him of like Saratoga Springs or something in Germany. And he thought, oh my gosh, this is going to be the Saratoga of the United States. He was going to pipe lithia water, or just sulfurous water, to town and just create these bathhouses everywhere. And he thought, oh, I have so much money, we're going to make this happen. And the people of Ashland, turns out, weren't really for it so much. And he was actually a person that was sort of always stepping on toes, but everybody put up with him. And I must say also that he only lived here for a couple of years. He made serious donations to the city's hospital at the time, which is, I think, why probably city officials put up with him so much. But he also lived in a couple of cabins up where Reeder Reservoir currently is, mm-hmm. and people would always catch him grazing his cattle around the reservoir and
just the drinking water for the city.
Yeah, fishing in the reservoir and, you know, just doing things that you probably should not be doing around the drinking water supply. So he was ticketed a number of times for that.
And yet there is a street name for it that runs parallel to Ashland Creek that, you know, carries the city's water supply.
Exactly. Yeah.
Winburn Way. It, you know, it's certainly a collection in these first few years of Ashland up to 1861, a collection of bearded white men. But then there's also Lizzie Anderson. What's her story?
Lizzie Anderson. She was Eli Anderson's wife. I remember that. And Lizzie, I think, was just, she was one of the first women in Ashland. She wasn't the first. But, oh, that's right. She was a teacher, though. And she helped save Abel Hellman's son. He was 15 months at the time, and he actually fell from just below, like, the cupola of the flour mill.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the flour mill. She rushed him over to Ashland Creek and dunked him in the water is what this journal entry describes her as doing. And he just sort of took a breath and came back to life. And it was just, you know, she wasn't the first woman in Ashland, and she doesn't have a very, I guess, renown mm-hmm. history or one that's super notable. But I just, you know, that's just a very cool little bit, I thought.
Lots of little fun anecdotes as you go along. And I should point out, too, that the book, you know, like any book that comes out from Arcadia, like all the town books and now the Legendary Locals books, lots and lots of pictures in here. The one of Lizzie Anderson is particularly striking. She's looking at the camera in a very modern kind of way. I mean, she doesn't look all dead in the eyes like a lot of pictures from that time do.
Well, she was pretty well off being married to Eli Anderson, who was an entrepreneur in Ashland as it was beginning and partners with Hellman. So I don't think she probably didn't have as harsh of a life as a lot of the people.
Dead in the eyes came from being fatigued.
And another thing you mentioned that there's a lot of old white bearded men in the first 30 pages of this book. You're not the only one that noticed that. I mean, I had friends that said, well, where are all the women? They flat out asked me, and I thought, you know, you're right. And I, in addition to the Native Americans, there's very little history on the women of the Rogue Valley around, you know, the 1850s, 1860s, 70s, 80s, and in, you know, up until suffrage. Really, it's very very limited, and it's unfortunate. There's a very small book that's like 30 pages long that's written. It's called Women of Southern Oregon or something. It's only about women, their stories around the region. But even that had very few people, that were around the Ashland area. So, you know, that's another thing that needs to be expanded on, I think.
History of women in the region, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely, because they played a very important role, and it's just not documented because of arrogant men of the late 1800s.
Sam Wheeler is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of Legendary Locals of Ashland. Now, the second period in the book runs 1861 to 1900. Now, the 1861, obviously the outbreak of the Civil War. And you write that it made Ashlanders a bit uneasy, as wars will do. But were there divided loyalties in town?
Certainly there were. And I would say probably, well, I don't want to throw out percentages, but most of the people were probably on the side of the South at that time around Ashland, and the town has by no means always been sort of a bastion of acceptance or
tolerance
is the word I was looking for.
Well, we can jump straight to that, into the fact that it was 60 years after the beginning of the Civil War, was a hotbed of Ku Klux Klan activity at a time when the Klan really swept across Oregon.
Yeah, I mean, there are photos of the Ku Klux Klan marching down Siskiyou Boulevard during the 4th of July parade, I think it is. So if that doesn't say it, then I don't know what else does. There are actually a couple of accounts that in the OS, the Shakespeare Festival archives, of some of the early black actors and actresses that were a part of the festival, and their accounts of racism in town and their sort of uneasiness about coming here initially. and how Angus Bomer, the founder of the festival, said, you know, come, we'll, you know, we have such a good theater community that we'll be able to take care of you. Yeah, it's Ashland's history is very white. There's no doubt about that.
No question, white and male. Yeah. I have to remember that for the first 20 years of the second chapter of the book, there was no Medford. Medford didn't exist until the 1880s. So how important then was Ashland to the county and the region at that time?
Ashland was the economic, cultural hub of the region following the Jacksonville area being mined out, pretty much.
So Jacksonville peaked and then began to subside at the time that Ashland was on the rise?
Yeah, Jacksonville peaked and fell off really rather quickly in the first probably 20 years. And then Ashland really took its spot. This is where the stagecoach passed through. This was the first stop for people coming from California, the last stop for people going to California. And it was right at the base of the Siskiyous, which even still sometimes are daunting to get over. And when you're talking about a mule drawn wagon, you can imagine how important and nice, you know, a good night's rest and a good meal would be.
Absolutely. Ashland is the focus of the book, Legendary Locals of Ashland, focusing on the people. Sam Wheeler wrote it. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the Legendary Locals of Ashland. A book by that name is now out from Arcadia Publishing. It's the same Arcadia Publishing that has put together a model where it sells books all across the country by making histories of small towns here and there, including lots of Rogue Valley towns and towns in Northern California as well. Now, there's a companion series called Legendary Locals, which focuses on the people. Sam Wheeler, a freelance journalist who's worked for both the Tidings and the Mail Tribune, is the author of Legendary Locals of Ashland. And you can join us as we talk about some of the major figures in Ashland history and the process of putting the book together. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about Ashland and its rise as Jacksonville fell, and then, of course, as Medford came into being about three decades into Ashland's history, it began to eclipse Ashland as well. But the economic base of Ashland really did have to change over time, didn't it?
It absolutely did. It has taken on several different faces. It was primarily oriented with the railroad. It was Ashland Mills first, so it was lumber and flour and supplies for the valley. I think the first flour ground in Oregon south of Roseburg by an actual mill was in Ashland. And, I mean, if you just look at the area, you have the Illinois Valley with all the miners there and then Jacksonville and even sending supplies, you know, up all the way pretty much to the Willamette. Then down into Yreka. It then, as the railroad came through, Ashland was a stop for the railroad before it went over the mountains, just as it was the stagecoaches. And it employed a lot of people, not only building the railroad. This is where they connected. This is where the track around the entire United States connected in Ashland. It's where the Golden Spike was driven. So there were a lot of people living in Ashland as they were building the track over the Siskiyous and north to Portland. That did switch as the railroad company.
They built a new line through Klamath Falls.
Through Klamath, so they wouldn't have to go over the Siskiyous and bypassing Ashland, and that wasn't good for the town, and a lot of people, you know, were a little unsettled about that.
I never thought about the fact that the Natron Cutoff, as it's known, opened up in 1927. So basically 2 years before the stock market crash that triggered the Great Depression, Ashland had its own big economic upheaval as
Ashland got the, left and right hook on that one.
Reverend Henry Skidmore is an interesting name in the book. He had an idea that lives on to today.
He opened Ashland Academy, which was later changed its name to Ashland College, which later changed its name to a variety of state college. I can't name them all, but it evolved into Southern Oregon University over time. So Skidmore, obviously a very important person to the community. I think the first one was established near where the Briscoe School is.
Oh, really?
On North Main.
Okay.
And he had about 40 students or so. That was in beginning of 1880s, so about 82.
So a mile or two from where the current campus of Southern Oregon University is. Yeah. We talked a little bit about the Southern Oregon University history. In fact, there are three in a row in the book in the Shaping Prosperity period post 1900: Julius Churchill, Elmo Stevenson, and Angus Bomer. Obviously, Angus is not famous for what happened on campus at SOU, but off campus. In the case of Elmo Stevenson, I mean Churchill, for whom Churchill Hall is named, the administration building at Southern Oregon University, a major pillar. Elmo Stevenson, I'd heard once that he arrived in town with orders to begin the process of shutting it down.
He did, actually. He did arrive. Was it from Western Oregon University, or is
somewhere else in the state university system?
University system, and he arrived in Ashland, and he was going to be the one that sort of saw through that transition and let everybody down easy. It didn't quite turn out like that, actually, and he sort of helped turn things around. And he wasn't here for a very long time, but he made a very significant impact on the school and really just revived the community's support for it.
And that was Stevenson, for whom Stevenson Union at Southern Oregon University is named. Let's take a phone call. We have Connie and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Sam Wheeler about legendary locals of Ashland.
Hate to interrupt all the conversation about the history of the area, but I just have a quick question about the process. I've seen these types of books by probably that publisher that you're using, and I was just curious, how do they verify what their authors write? I'm not denigrating you at all, but what's the process that they make sure that your material is correct, or names, dates? Do they have a whole section that works on that, and if so, how do they do that?
Good question. Thanks for that, Connie.
Yeah, great question. Well, I send the book in. I send my final text in about 3 months in advance of them getting back to me with their version of it. So they, in that 3 month period, they do all the grammatical fact checking, they do all of the fact checking during that 3 month period. And I would assume that that's how they do it. Of course, they would also have to rely on whoever they seek out to write the book, that they have some amount of credibility anyway.
You're pretty young, though. I mean, would they look anybody older who had been living in the Ashland area a bit longer?
I don't know. I never did ask. I never asked them how they came across my name. Never met them face to face. They're in South Carolina. So I'm really not sure.
Interesting. So, all right. So, back to some of the people in the book. James Sutton is in here. He created a place you once worked, the Ashland Daily Tidings. And it's interesting to find out that he chose the name Tidings because, it sounds British, maybe Shakespearean, but years before the Shakespeare Festival.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know too much about why he actually chose Ashland Daily Tidings. He had been the editor, and I believe he was the founder as well, of the Jacksonville Sentinel, is what it was called. The newspaper there. An interesting fact is at that time he used to lead weekend trips up to Crater Lake during the summer with community members, and he was the one that actually dubbed the lake Crater Lake. And it's not named after the caldera that the lake is in. It's named after the very small crater on the tip of the mountain, are the little butte that's on Wizard Island.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, so a little crater, not big crater.
Yeah.
Interesting. So there is a villain in here. We're going to be a few villains in here. We can skip over the D'Autremont brothers, who I think is a very well-known story about the last attempted train robbery in America and the failure there that resulted in the death of four crew members. But we have a Black Bart in the book.
Black Bart. Yeah. Black Bart was a train robber, but he was a poet as well. I can't remember the number of trains that he robbed off the top of my head, but there were several of them throughout the Sierra Nevadas and the Siskiyous, just throughout the western United States, really. He would just, you know, take a little dynamite, I would imagine, and blow off a side of the hill, and the train would stop, and he would stick everybody up very cordially, I understand, and go ahead and make off with his loot. Never did kill anybody, which was what sort of separates him and allows us to romanticize him as compared to the D'Autremont brothers. They did a terrible job at their train robbery, blew the whole thing to smithereens, and ended up, unfortunately, killing several people. But Black Bart, he's an interesting fellow, and he has a bit of mystery as to what ended up happening to him as well, because he was imprisoned and let out, I think, like 10 years later around the Bay Area, and nobody ever heard from him again.
Really? So, okay, yeah. So Black Bart just fading like a poem into history.
Yeah, he wrote poems, too, and left them at his train robbers. This is why I say the poet. Wow. Black Bart the poet.
Hua Chung, a pillar of the community in Ashland. Interesting to see when we talk about the predominance of white males in the history of Ashland. It's nice to see all diversity there. What was Hua Chung's story?
Well, Hua Chung was... he was a labor boss, is what he was. So, Ish certainly wasn't an old white male, but he was probably on their side and having dinner with them a lot. He was the person who brought a lot of the Chinese labor to Southern Oregon to dig ditches, to lay the train tracks. Most of the history that is written about him is fairly positive, but I can only imagine if you were one of the, you know, Chinese individuals working on the railroad or digging tunnels, you might not have a favorable opinion of Mr. Hua Chung. However,
he was a boss.
He was the boss, is pretty much. Yeah. He controlled the Chinese labor in the area.
You mentioned Charles Crocker briefly about bringing the railroad to Ashland. Also in that same period, George Billings gives us a way to understand the Chautauqua movement. Tell us a bit about the Chautauqua movement and what it was and how it ended up setting up shop on a semi-permanent basis in Ashland.
Well, the Chautauqua movement was really, I would, for lack of a better phrase, like an intellectual traveling circus, you know, where...
Without the
acrobats, yeah. Instead of acrobatics, they would have, readings, people, presenting different research topics on anything from around the globe. Billings was a part of the initial group of people who met actually in Central Point to discuss bringing Chautauqua to Southern Oregon, bringing, the traveling show to Southern Oregon. Presentation is more of what it was than a show.
Like lectures and speeches.
Exactly. Arts. And Central Point was actually going to be the location because it was in the Central Valley. It was easier to get to. But Billings was very adamant in saying, no, we need to bring it to Ashland. We need to bring it to Ashland. And what really solidified that was the community's response and community members getting together and building the dome, which the walls, the foundational walls of which house the Elizabethan stage of the Shakespeare Festival today. So Billings was a powerful community leader at the time. And so for him to stand up and say, no, we have to bring it to Ashland and for it to actually happen, that's how he made his name for himself.
And this is before the turn of the 20th century, and those walls, those outer walls stood outside the Elizabethan Theater at the Shakespeare Festival until the early 90s when they built the current pavilion out there.
Exactly.
So quite an enduring legacy. And, of course, it gave a place for the Shakespeare Festival to set up, which brings us to Angus Bohmer and the whole process of getting the Shakespeare Festival set up. And so he just the whole story about the boxing interrelationship is always a fun one.
I know. That's great. The Shakespeare Festival was started by Oregon Shakespeare Festival was started by Angus Bohmer. And how he initially got it going was through the city of Ashland during the 4th of July. I can't remember the year off the top of my head, but
1935, wasn't it?
1935 it was. he said, well, why don't we do this thing where, you know, we'll put on a few plays and the Chautauqua on the stage there, and because the building had actually been torn down at that point. So they sort of revamped the stage where the Chautauqua Foundation was and got it all set up, and everybody wasn't so sure how it was going to go over. Bummer said, well, we'll throw in a few boxing matches to go with it. And people thought, oh, okay. The city officials thought, okay, we'll let it go.
Because that'll bring in the money.
That'll bring in the money. Turns out nobody really watched the probably half-rate boxing matches, and a lot of people came to see the theater. And it ended up actually bringing in more money than the boxing. So the city thought, all right, this is maybe Angus is onto something here. And, I mean, he continually pursued. The man is just, it's amazing to read about it and to watch some of the old videos that are in the Shakespeare Festival archives, mm-hmm. of the amount of work that he did to just not only for the Shakespeare Festival, but at Southern Oregon University as a professor, at the old Vining Theater that he totally revamped so that Shakespeare Festival company, but the company that he ran during the winter months could have a place to perform. I mean, it was unreal, his dedication to theater arts. And
I can imagine he's a person you really wish you had a chance to meet for this book. Not possible anymore, of course.
Yeah.
Any people you're really glad you didn't get a chance to meet in person?
Of course. Well,
villains and Klansmen, maybe?
Yeah, the Klansmen. You know, when I see that picture of Charles Crocker, the guy who drove the Golden Spike, he just looks very very harsh. I don't know. It doesn't look like a guy I want to sit down and have a cup of coffee with or something like that.
So I'm sure this is a whole lot of work because you're busy putting it together, but I mean, does it feel fun now that you're on the outside of it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to see a copy of it sitting here on the table in front of me.
Legendary Locals of Ashland. Do you get asked to do the Legendary Locals of Medford next or something?
I don't know. I haven't been asked, and I don't know if I will be.
All right, Legendary Locals of Ashland, out from Arcadia Publishing, which also has books about Ashland and talent and Medford and a lot of other communities. And Sam Wheeler is the author of the book. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
It's great to have you.